Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Thank you so much. It is a great pleasure and privilege to be with you all today. And I'm looking forward to speaking about an area of specialization for me. I am primarily a metaphysician, which I believe will become very evident in the course of this talk. But today, the question that was posed to me by Father Ambrose for reflection was whether or not the sun or light could be a universal cause in contemporary science, as it was for those in the Aristotelian tradition. Now, I will confess that while the causes and universals warm my Thomistic metaphysician's heart, and I live in Southern California, the sun is not something to which I had thus far devoted much philosophical consideration, nor am I a scientist. So even though I have a visual presentation, I am reading a prepared paper. But, like most things, it quickly proved to be quite interesting. Not so much in itself, although it was intriguing to see to what extent Thomas's understanding of the sun tracks what we now know, but certainly in how the sun was used to illustrate a number of foundational philosophical principles and concepts, including of paramount importance, universal causality. Although Thomas devotes little attention directly to the sun, and I'll qualify that in a little bit, he frequently employed it as an example to illustrate other central concerns. Recognizing, as he did, that human learning progresses from what is better known to what is less known, the sun was an outstanding example for him inasmuch as it was, well, obvious. It's also a recurring example of an issue that is central to the entirety of Thomistic thought, namely the causes and universal causes. Also called common, universal causes have wide application and numerous implications. In the interest of time, though, I'll mention just two ways that these kinds of causes are of importance to us. First, what I will call science. Now, given present company especially, I have to unpack what I mean by this term. As expounded in the Posterior Analytics of Aristotle, science, which is a somewhat clunky English translation of scientia, which is itself the Latin translation of the Greek episteme, has two distinct but connected meanings. First, a particular kind of human knowledge, demonstrative certain knowledge of a given thing through identification of its causes. Second, an organized body of investigation aimed at acquiring this kind of knowledge. For Thomas, scientia or episteme, in the sense of causal knowledge, involves knowing a thing universally in some way or another. Not just this thing, inasmuch as it is this individual, but this thing inasmuch as it is like and unlike other things. So, for example, I know my nephew or my dog not just when I know them as individual beings, but as individuals of a kind. One is a human, both like and unlike all other humans, and the other is a dog, both like and unlike all other dogs. I might go farther, even, and say that they are both animals, like and unlike all other animals, and for that matter, each other. Or that they are living, like and unlike all other living things, or even that they are both material. Each level of universality, identifying what is common to them, animal, living, material, yields greater insight into what they are. Had I stopped at knowledge of my nephew or my dog as individuals, then my knowledge would be limited. Thomas therefore reminds us that it is through the universal cause that we demonstrate something in the universal way that constitutes science, again, the sense of knowledge. So, the first way universal causes are important is insofar as they allow us to reach a particular kind of knowledge. Another way, or area, in which universal causes are important in the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition is the issue of creation. Now, by this, I do not particularly have in mind the issue of whether or not the universe had a temporal beginning. Rather, I mean, along with Thomas, the bringing into being or existence of something from nothing, or creation ex nihilo. His own exposition of the term creation shows the importance of universal causes inasmuch as creation refers to the bringing about not just of particular beings, but of all beings, created being itself. The substantive creation, furthermore, can also be taken in a way as coextensive with the universe, the reality in which we live. And in this sense, creation is universal, and as such, Thomas is concerned with what kind of cause could account for this kind of effect. These two distinct issues interconnect. For Thomas, we naturally desire to know, and we want to know what is the nature of reality. To know anything in the rich sense of scientia requires that we know its causes as much and as well as we can. Indeed, for Thomas, metaphysics, or what he calls wisdom, the highest philosophical science, that highest body of investigation, is fundamentally concerned with universal causes. Universal causes are thus centrally important to the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition in general, but I have been asked with considering the sun in the Aristotelian tradition. In breaking down this question posed to me, I had to consider, and so we'll consider today, first, the causes in general. Second, universal causes. Third, the sun. And finally, the sun as a universal cause. In the time we have today, then, I propose considering each of these in turn. Small mistakes in the beginning, I remind myself, however, soon become great if left unchecked, so we do have to begin with some basics. In the Aristotelian tradition, the four causes identify four answers to fundamental questions about a given thing. This is a bit of a callback to our first day of presentations, of course. What is X? What is the thing we're trying to understand? What is the stuff out of which it is made? Who or what made or did it? And what is it for? The answer to the first question identifies the thing's formal cause. The answer to the second, its material cause. The answer to the third, its efficient cause. And the answer to the fourth, the thing's final cause. In identifying the four causes of any given thing, we come to knowledge or scientia of it. So for instance, I might explain that the armoire, now standing in my living room in Los Angeles, at least I hope it is, it's been a few weeks since I've been there, is a piece of furniture. That's its formal cause. It's made of wood, it's a material cause, which stores a variety of household items. That's its final cause. What's it for? Which was made by someone sometime before I bought it on Facebook Marketplace, which are both efficient causes of it being in my living room, although in slightly different respects. Or I might explain that Marty is a dog, that's his formal cause, who weighs 65 pounds and has shaggy black hair, some of his material causes, not all of them, who runs, barks, and sleeps, and occasionally strikes dramatic poses in the Center for Thomistic Studies, and keeps me company, which is one of his final causes, but certainly not the most important, and we can talk about that if you'd like. These examples suggest that the four causes answer fundamental questions about a variety of things, animate or not, natural or not, and so forth. And so it's always fun, for example, when I teach medieval philosophy, Thomas Aquinas uses this causal series to talk about things like law, so not even a physical thing. Because of the central importance of identifying the causes of a given thing, a number of distinctions have been delineated for each within the Aristotelian tradition. Thomas, for instance, identifies four modes, each of which pertain to each of the four causes. The first mode concerns the relation between priority and posteriority within a given kind of cause. This relation includes such distinctions as those between common and proper causes, and the distinction between universal and particular causes. So consider, for example, a house, and this is Thomas's example. In coming to understand this construction, we would need to identify, among other things, its efficient cause, who made it, who made or produced this. We might say that, generally, an artisan made the house, but that's hardly specific. Artisans, as we know, make all sorts of things, houses, furniture, sculpture, sure, clothing, cakes, clocks, and so forth. The kind of artisan who constructs a house is a builder, and it is builder which identifies what we are calling the proper cause of this construction. Similarly, inasmuch as my nephew, pictured here, is a human being, he is also essentially and formally an animal. And I had to include a picture of him because I was holding him as I was writing this section. The TAs get younger every year. But to say simply that he is an animal does not specifically get at what kind of animal he is compared to, say, my dog, which was lying at my feet when I was reading these same passages. So we must identify his proper cause, human. This first mode is very important for our present concern, so I'll come back to it in a moment. First, though, let's briefly consider the other three modes. The second mode concerns the distinction between per se and per accidens causes. This gets at what the precise cause of a given effect is and what is in some way incidental about it. Returning to our example of the builder, the per se cause of the house is a builder. It is incidental that this individual builder is, I don't know, Jack. The builder might very well have been Bob. Bob's a builder. The house is not made inasmuch as this cause is Jack, but inasmuch as Jack, this individual, is a particular kind, is a builder. Now, in reality, of course, Jack is the builder in question, but this aspect of this individual builder is incidental, or to use this terminology, per accidens, to the building of this effect. The aspect which is not incidental, that aspect which equips this individual to bring about the effect of building the house, is that he is a builder. The third mode concerns the distinction between potency and act. And this is important because it allows an identification of the causal relationship between cause and effect, even apart from the activity of causing. So Jack is a builder in potency before he builds the house, inasmuch as he could but is not yet constructing it. And he is a builder in actuality when he is engaged in building it. He's a builder throughout, just in potency versus in act. The fourth and final mode concerns how a given cause may be simple or complex. This mode allows one to identify and distinguish the different aspects of a given cause. So, for example, again, the cause of the house we've been considering is in reality Jack. This is a complex cause inasmuch as Jack is not just a builder, that's not all there is to him, but also, say, a father, a bicyclist, or a baker. Each of these are aspects of Jack, arguably just as much of him as any other aspect, but only some of these, per se, concern a given effect of building the house. Others do not. This distinction also allows us to understand a given effect which is dependent on a variety or multiplicity of causes. Think, for instance, of understanding this builder as the son of someone. Sons are caused, they are the effects of two parents, his mother and his father. This person's per se efficient cause, thus, is complex. Each of these modes offer a way to identify with precision what a cause is and how it is a cause. The mode of most importance for present purposes, though, is the first, as this encompasses how a cause may be universal. In his exposition, Thomas refers to such universal causes as common, which indicates to us some notion, some hint of what makes a universal cause universal, namely, that it is common in some way. A universal cause, understood thus, is not radically different from the proper cause, nor is the prior cause radically separate from the posterior. Without some underlying fundamental sameness, there is no commonality. It is this underlying similarity and connection which is centrally important for Thomas. So he expands on how a cause may be common. Here, in this passage and a few others, distinguishing two ways that a common cause may be common. The first is what he calls a commonness in predication. The example that he gives is of a doctor, an artisan, and health. The proper and posterior cause of health, that is the direct efficient cause, of health is the doctor. That's who brings it about. And it is the doctor, properly speaking, that brings about the health in the patient. But Thomas notes doctor itself is a specific instance of a more general class of workers. While we may not normally name doctor when thinking through various kinds of artisans, bakers or painters come more to my mind, there is some underlying similarity. Each must, in their own way, undergo specialized training to acquire the requisite skills needed to bring specific effects about. If we understand artisan as including all professions requiring specific training, then doctor, and for that matter many other professions, must be included. For this reason, Thomas maintains the artisan is the more common and prior cause of health. There is a commonality to doctor and artisan, inasmuch as we may make similar predications of each. We can say things about them. So a doctor is trained and an artisan is trained to bring about a given effect, although their effects are quite different from each other. Inasmuch as the class of artisan is not limited to medical training, artisan is common, and in this way, universal. The second is a commonness of causality. The example that Thomas gives is particularly apt for today. The sun is a universal cause of heating, which I'm going to come back to later on in this presentation. The sun is a universal cause of heating, but fire is a proper cause. In this case, we are not merely predicating the same thing, that the sun and fire are both hot, for example, but sun and fire, but instead identifying an underlying causal connection. For Thomas, fire is hot inasmuch as it is itself caused to be hot. The ultimate cause of heat is the sun. Understood in this way, the things that are heated by fire, such as a pot of water you might put on a stove, is heated directly by fire, so fire is the proper cause, but that fire is only able to cause water to heat because it is itself already heated by the sun. So the sun for Thomas is a common cause of the heat of the fire, and through the fire, the heat of the pot of water. In this way, too, Thomas thinks the sun is a prior and universal common cause. What is of concern for Thomas in both kinds of commonality, predication and causality, is an underlying metaphysical similarity between discrete things, doctors and artisans, or fire and the sun. This similarity allows one to relate one to another in real and non-arbitrary ways. Another way of understanding universal causes, which have been used in some of the examples so far, but really warrants further investigation, so we're going to do that now, is of universal causes as distinguished from particular causes. This way of conceiving of universal causes assumes the widely employed, albeit sometimes contended, distinction between universals and particulars. Universals, very simply put, are general. They're general concepts, general terms, or general realities. Existence, triangle, dog, and coffee are all examples of these general terms or concepts. When I use these terms, I do not mean some specific being, specific triangle, dog, or coffee, but rather what is essential about each of these different things. Particulars, by contrast, are individual in some way, some individual concept, term, or reality. So, for instance, I might refer not to existence universally, although as a metaphysician I do that a lot, but to the particular existent that is the Dominican House of Studies, or my particular dog, Marty. There is an underlying metaphysical connection between the universal, dog, and Marty. And if there were not, then I would be hard-pressed to say that that individual is a dog, both like and unlike all other dogs. We can employ this distinction between universal and particular to the relation between causes and effects also. In this way, we might say that the universal dog is a cause, a formal cause, of Marty, or the universal triangle is a universal cause of all triangles. Similarly, the particular dog Marty that I've been talking about is the particular cause of, for example, perhaps a whole dog in my backyard, and the particular coffee beans are the particular causes of the cup of coffee that I drank earlier today. We should note at this point that the line between universal and particular in this sense is not always cleanly drawn. We might say, for example, that the universal, dog, is a cause, a sort of formal cause of Labrador Retriever and Poodle. But each of these is also, in a way, a universal that includes particular Labrador Retrievers and Poodles. We should also note that universal causes need not themselves be a universal concept, term, or reality, but rather a particular thing which has many distinct effects and is the cause of all effects of the same kind, such as the example of a sun, a particular thing, being a universal cause of heating many different distinct things. Universal causes for Thomas, thus, are often relatively, not absolutely, universal. Now, of course, Thomas does maintain that there is a being who is the most universal and the most prior cause, God. And we're going to talk about that in a second. Given the distinctions just considered, anything for Thomas may be considered a universal cause inasmuch as it is the cause of all like effects, and universal causes may be more or less encompassing. For Thomas, particular causes and universal causes differ in one rather important way, namely that universal causes may still be present, existent, or operative, even if a particular cause is somehow thwarted. So for instance, if I'm teaching and I want to try to draw a rectangle on the board, but due to my woeful lack of spatial visualization and even less artistic ability, I end up drawing something that might charitably be construed as a trapezoid or a parallelogram, the universal cause of four-sided plane figure is still present, even when a particular cause, me, failed to bring rectangle about on the board. So recognizing that universal causes may be more or less universal, and that particulars are effects in some way of universal causes, and less universal causes are themselves effects of more universal causes, Thomas asks whether there is one universal cause that is universal not merely relatively, as we've been focusing on, but absolutely. Universal causes are universal inasmuch as they are the cause of all like effects. So a universal cause that is absolutely universal must include all things as its effects. When considering reality, as we've been doing so far, in terms of causes and effects, both universal and particular, we are considering existing causes and existing effects, coupled to one another through some real similarity, relation, or connection. But there could be no connections between beings if they were not first and foremost beings or existing. If existence, then, is what is common to all beings, Thomas concludes, then an absolutely universal cause would have to be the cause of existence. In a relatively early treatise, and I should note the smaller phrases in italics are all references to texts where Thomas gives these. There wasn't enough time to read out all of these passages, but if you're interested, these are all widely available online. In a relatively early treatise, De Ente et Essentia, Thomas explored the foundational metaphysical issues of being or existence and essence. He notes that in every real being, there is an important and radical difference between their nature, their essence, or what they are, and the fact that they are or that they exist. He illustrates this by stating that I can understand what a man is or what a phoenix is, and nevertheless not know whether either has existence in reality. Now, I'll presume that we all have a rough idea of what a phoenix is. It's an immortal bird, endures throughout a series of lifetimes, and the duration varies depending on whom you ask, and it explodes into flames at the end of one lifetime and rises from the ashes to begin another. All right, so that's what Thomas is thinking about. We all, for Thomas, he thinks, in using this example, have an essential grasp of what a phoenix is. We could all answer what is a phoenix by sort of rehearsing what I just went through. Similarly, we have an essential grasp of what a man is. An individual of the class Homo sapiens, perhaps, or, as I tend to prefer, an individual who is a rational animal. Were I to have a brother, or a son, or a nephew, each of them would be individuals of this kind. But while we might have an essential grasp of phoenixes and men, we do not thereby know that such a bird, brother, or son exist. In Thomas's account of essence and existence, existence becomes one of the many attributes that may belong to a given essence. When an essence has existence, or actually is, then it has reality. It does not exist merely conceptually. While existence is one of many attributes a given thing may have, for Thomas it is sui generis. It is unique. It is irreplaceable. Existence is what makes another all other attributes, and indeed the thing itself, to be at all. In considering the various attributes of a thing, Thomas thus distinguishes that they might either be caused by the principles of the thing, that is, by what the kind of thing it is causing something, or from something outside of that thing's essence. The example that he uses repeatedly to talk about these kinds of attributes are caused by the principles of a thing is risibility, or our ability to laugh. Inasmuch as we are animals, we have vocal cords. And inasmuch as we are rational, we can comprehend irony and get a joke. Or at the very least, be aware that someone was trying to be funny and maybe give a pity laugh. But regardless, the principles of our nature, animal, rational, that which makes us to be the kind of things that we are, entails that we have this ability, that we are risible. Existence cannot be caused the way risibility or the ability to laugh is, because if it were, then a being would be causing its own existence. But in order to cause anything to exist, you have to first exist, and so it's clearly circular. So existence for Thomas is caused by something outside the thing. The only thing which could cause existence in this way must be ultimately itself uncaused. And so Thomas concludes, all things have existence from the first being, which is existence alone, and this is the first cause, which is God. The universal causes are universal, again, inasmuch as they are the cause of all like effects. The effect under consideration now is the most universal, existence, that attribute which all beings possess inasmuch as they are. God, then, is the highest and most universal of causes, and it is in coming to know this that we attain the highest knowledge of the highest reality. But the higher the reality, often the more difficult it is to grasp. And so Thomas utilizes a number of parallels and examples to lead us to this knowledge. One parallel, of which he is particularly fond, is the sun. Before turning to the sun as a universal cause, let's consider the sun in itself. Now, although, as I mentioned briefly at the beginning of this presentation, Thomas dedicates little attention to the sun as such, I have to qualify that now and say, at least compared to his invocation of it as an example. If you look at dedicated treatments expounding what is the sun in its nature, it's relatively rare. If you search through the entirety of the Thomistic corpus for instances of the sun, let alone light, I stop counting at 1,000. So he uses it all over. So, in the interest, his references indicate a fairly expansive understanding of this, but we have to piece it together. In the interest of time, I'll limit myself to 5 of the most common or the most frequent attributes that he identifies. First, the sun is a distinct individual. There is, for Thomas, only one sun, and this one sun is the only member of a unique species. Seemingly relying primarily on direct observation, there is only one sun, and one suffices for the necessary solar effects in the world. Given that one suffices, then, Thomas thinks, there need be only one. Going hand in hand with the attribute of unique individuality is second that the sun is incorruptible, at least in some sense. Corruption is a kind of change, as I believe we heard on the first day of this conference. More precisely, corruption is the contrary of generation. While generation is the coming to be of something that once was not, corruption is the ceasing to be of something that once was, coming into and going out of existence. The sense in which the sun is incorruptible is in its motion. This motion is not the losing or the acquiring of some new form or actuality, and in this sense is neither generation nor corruption. And so in that sense, Thomas says the sun is incorruptible. Nonetheless, the important qualification here is that the sun is, in another respect, corruptible, inasmuch as it, like all created things, is radically dependent on a cause for its existence, as we just discussed. These first two attributes, unique and incorruptible, interconnect. Multiplicity within a species is, in part, required for Thomas if there is to be reproduction. Eternal things have no need to reproduce, because none of them pass away, which means none of them need to produce a replacement, so there need only be one of each kind. The universe, or what we would call today more precisely call the solar system, thus for Thomas needs only one sun. Third, the sun is invariable. What is meant by this is not that the sun always has and always will bring a given effect about, but rather that the sun is operative, essentially, in distinctive and predictable ways. As Thomas states in the context of angelic knowledge, so again, he's using the sun as an example of something quite unrelated in a way. Some future events are determined in their proximate causes in such a way as to happen necessarily from them. For example, tomorrow's rising of the sun. The basis for this attribute is the nature of the sun. Given that it is an incorruptible individual of a particular kind, it acts in distinctive ways, such as rising regularly. Of course, Thomas does not thereby mean that the sun is an instance of determinism, according to which the sun will and must rise. The sun's effects have, in the Aristotelian tradition, a suppositional or hypothetical necessity. If a given effect occurred, such as a plant bearing fruit, then necessarily the sun was operative as a prior cause. No sun, no flowering plants. This is not what we might call a hard determinism, however, because plants may not flower. Certainly all the living plants that I buy quickly die. I need things to whine so I remember to feed them and give them water and stuff. Anyway, the sun then is invariable in the sense of following a determined and predictable course, an order ultimately resulting from some kind of providential ordering. Fourth, the sun is a cause, and we can come to knowledge of this being through its effects. As he explains, this time in the context of how we come to know divine law, so we're really jumping contexts here, a thing may be known in two ways, first in itself, second in its effect, wherein some likeness of that thing is found. Thus, someone not seeing the sun in its substance may know it by its rays. We come to know the sun for Thomas at least in part by observing its illumination. Although I recently had to remind my students, because I'll use this as an example, don't look directly at the sun, even in eclipses, especially then. Right? Just don't do that. Right? But we can come to some knowledge of the sun by witnessing its effects of illumination. Related to this, fifth, is that the sun illuminates by its own power or nature, while other celestial beings for Thomas do not. As he states, the sun, which possesses light perfectly, can shine by itself, whereas the moon, which has the nature of light imperfectly, sheds only a borrowed light. Put another way, the sun illuminates because it is fully luminate, while the moon illuminates only imperfectly, inasmuch as it is itself illuminated by the sun. Before turning to consider how the sun may be a universal cause, we need to unpack the causality of the sun a bit more. Recalling the second mode of causality mentioned earlier in this presentation, the sun is a per se cause. Like Jack the Builder, who constructs a house inasmuch as he is a builder, the sun illuminates inasmuch as it is luminate. The sun is able to cause or give illumination for Thomas from the very property of its nature. The sun, though, is not a univocal cause, meaning that although it causes inasmuch as it is the kind of thing that it is, its effects need not be the same in kind. Now, one of the most important concepts into mystic metaphysics is the distinction between univocal, equivocal, and analogical terms and concepts. So we need to pause and think about this for a bit. Simply put, univocal terms are when one uses the same word with the same meaning. So for example, when I say that my dog Marty is a dog and my sister's dog Achilles is a dog, I'm using dog in the same way for each. Same word, same meaning. Equivocal terms, by contrast, are the same word with totally different meanings. For example, I might say that the dogs are tired, in reference to Marty and Achilles, or I might say that my dogs, gestures at feet, are tired after a long hike. Same word, totally different meanings. The dogs might be tired from the same hike, but they are not my feet. Totally different. Analogical terms are when we use the same term with a meaning that is somewhat or somehow the same and somewhat or somehow different. So continuing this example, I might say that someone dogs the steps of another, and I'm using dog to refer to that action, but there is a similarity to my dog's close and attentive focus on me. Analogical terms are, in a sense, equivocal because we're not using it in precisely the same way, but not what we might call outright equivocation. So while Thomas sometimes refers to the sun as an equivocal cause, the context, which is critically important for everything for Thomas, makes clear that this is a kind of analogy, and in no instance is it a univocal cause. An example of a univocal cause might be my mom, right? So if we think about my mom as somehow causing me, she causes me, a female human being, insofar as she is a female human being. Very different from the analogical causes that we're talking about with the sun. Let's now recall the first mode of causality presented and elaborated upon a little bit earlier in this presentation, the sun as a remote cause. Within the context of presenting how divine providence allows the presence of secondary causes, Thomas reminds us that, quote, certain effects are said to be necessary or contingent in relation to their proximate, not to their remote cause. Thus, for a plant to bear fruit is a contingent effect on account of the proximate cause, which is the power of germination that can be hindered and fail, although a remote cause, namely the sun, is a cause that acts of necessity, end quote. The sun is involved causally in plants flowering, but not directly for Thomas. There are a number of intermediate, proximate causes that must also be efficacious if this effect is to come about. The sun is a universal cause, which is common by causality, inasmuch as it is a being which is causally connected to a variety of disparate effects, more or less proximately. Now, while Thomas does not, again, devote extensive consideration directly to the question of the sun, let alone the sun as a universal cause, reviewing his numerous references allows one to identify a number of ways in which, for him, the sun is a cause in this way. So let's consider them now. First, and perhaps most obviously, certainly most frequently, is the sun as a universal cause of light or illumination. In claiming that the sun is a universal cause of light, he is not necessarily committed to the conclusion that the sun is a cause of all light absolutely considered, but rather often is centered on the sun's causality for light or illumination on the earth. For Thomas, the sun is a per se, but not necessarily proximate cause for light. It is a per se cause because it brings the effect of illumination about inasmuch as it is the kind of thing that it is. It is not proximate, though, because illumination can be transmitted through secondary connected causes, such as the air or ether, as we've been discussing. The claims that the sun is a per se but mediated cause leads Thomas to argue that, in a sense, there must be simultaneity between the causal action of the sun and its effects. Now, today, of course, we know that there is a temporal delay from the sun illuminating and the effects of light reaching the earth, approximately 8.3 minutes. This does not belie Thomas's claim regarding the simultaneity of the solar cause and its effects, though, because what is meant primarily by simultaneity here is that there must be this cause for these effects to come about and persist. If the sun were to stop existing, its effects would cease as well. Indeed, for Thomas, the effect of illumination is always and only dependent on an ultimate first cause. Going along with this understanding of the sun as a cause of light is of the sun as the cause of color and as a necessary condition for sight. Now, while we can piece together an understanding of the sun itself as a universal cause, these examples appear in the midst of expounding other issues. And indeed, Thomas himself seems much more interested in considering the sun as a universal cause for the sake of understanding some other aspect of reality. So, for example, one reference to the sun as a universal cause is the sun as the universal cause of the enlightening of bodies. But this passage itself is focused on a consideration of how God is a universal cause of the enlightening of souls. There, Thomas contrasts the natural causality of the sun and the free causality of God. The sun, inasmuch as it is the kind of thing that it is, causes light. God, who causes inasmuch as he is the kind of being that he is, causes freely in accord with his wisdom. In this passage, Thomas is concerned with explaining how God does metaphorically enlighten human beings, and he refers to the sun in order to point out the disanalogy. God freely gives his grace, while the sun illuminates inasmuch as it is what it is, with no volition at play. In another passage, too, the sun as a universal cause is invoked to contrast and explain how God is the ultimate cause of existence. As Thomas explains there, quote, "Now every creature may be compared to God, as the air is to the sun which enlightens it. For as the sun possesses light by its nature, and as the air is enlightened by sharing the sun's nature, so God alone is being in virtue of his own essence, since his essence is his existence. Whereas every creature has being by participation, so that its essence is not its existence." And we've unpacked that already in the De Ente treatment. Just as illumination depends in some way on the sun, so too all things other than God depends on God for their existence or their being. If the sun were to cease its causality, its illumination would stop. So too, if God removed his causality from his creatures, they would cease existing. At other times, the sun as universal cause of illumination is employed as a comparison to intellectual illumination or the perfection of human nature by grace. In each instance, we are the kind of being who could undergo intellectual causality or could receive the perfection of grace. The sun, an everyday and common cause, is referenced to illustrate these non-obvious instances of causality. The precise mechanism by which the sun illuminates the air is not for Thomas of primary importance. What Thomas is concerned with is the dependence of a given effect on its cause. The illuminated air depending on the sun as an example to explain existing creatures depending on God. Secondly, relatedly, and perhaps also not terribly surprisingly, is the sun as a universal cause of heating. In a passage already discussed, in which Thomas distinguishes the first mode of causes, he refers to the sun as the universal cause of heating before naming fire as the proper cause. Now, the example we considered there was the pot of water being heated properly and proximately by fire underneath it, but that fire itself is hot in as much as it shares in heat. Another example from a different text and a different context is a man who, quote, puts aside his clothing because the air becomes warm, the air having been heated in turn by the sun. What is at issue here in both cases for Thomas is, again, the causal interconnectedness of reality. Rather than getting caught up at the specific examples that he gives and then becoming tangled, trying to determine whether, and if so, how the sun is the cause of fire, we should, I think, first, not to say that those are unimportant, but we should first turn our attention to the point Thomas is attempting to illustrate, the gradations in nature of a given attribute. Now, this claim is important, among other places, in the fourth of Thomas's famous five ways of demonstrating the existence of God. In that argument, he concludes that God must exist inasmuch as there is a gradation of perfections among created things. But this gradation is only intelligible, indeed it's only possible, when compared to some maximum. The underlying issue there and here is that more and less are relative terms, which are meaningful only when anchored to something absolute. In suggesting that the sun is a universal cause of heat, Thomas is concerned with illustrating that there is a real causal connection between distinct, even different, natural things. Next, perhaps surprisingly, Thomas repeatedly referred to the sun as a universal cause of generation, sometimes generation in general, but often human generation particularly. Now, at first, this claim might strike one as odd. When listing out the factors involved in human generation, the sun does not usually come to mind. And when you're explaining human generation to children, I don't think you talk about the sun. I've not had to do this. But again, the temptation might well be to reject this as yet another of those quaint but antiquated attempts to explain the common but still astonishing effect of bringing forth new life. Invoking one of the senses of common examined above, namely common by predication and common by causality, Thomas asserts that the sun is the general cause of all things generated here below, or in other words, the sun is general by causality. In claiming that the sun is a universal cause of generation, he's getting at the metaphysical claim that causal series are somehow essentially and importantly connected. Thomas does not mean that the sun is a direct or proper cause of generation, but rather, inasmuch as the causes of greater or lesser proximity do ultimately depend on the sun, then it is causally connected to all of these various effects. Indeed, in another text, Thomas explicitly argues that the sun is not a proper cause of generation, but a cause nonetheless. Another aspect of Thomas's causal theory that he invokes in arguing for the sun as a universal cause in this sense of generation, like so many other important issues, is the distinction between univocal and analogical causes. Precisely because the sun is a universal cause of, among other effects, generation, it cannot be a univocal cause. So in claiming that the sun is a universal cause of generation, he does not mean that the sun is a generator in the way that, say, parents are. Something need not be univocal for Thomas to be a true cause. Finally, and less frequently, Thomas references the sun as a universal cause of motion. Here, too, we need to keep in mind that universal is a relative term. In claiming that the sun is a universal cause of motion, he has in mind the motion in the solar system. While he does refer to the sun as a planet, his claim regarding the causal connections between celestial bodies is not wholly inaccurate. Of all the planets, the sun is the largest in size, and its effect is more evident as lower bodies. And even the motions of the other planets are arranged in accordance with the motion of the sun, and in a sense are subsequent to it. Here we see again Thomas's view of reality as causally interconnected. The sun is not universal in the sense of being the cause of all motion absolutely in the universe. It is not the first cause, unmoved mover, but it is universal, relatively speaking. Now, to explore each of the references to the sun as cause, and the sun as a universal cause, is in greater detail, is sadly well beyond the present constraints of time. And indeed, the time to wrap up this talk is rapidly approaching. So to conclude, I would like to return to the question that kicked this whole thing off. We have seen how the sun is a universal cause in the Aristotelian Thomistic tradition. We naturally desire to know, and we want to know what is to know reality. To know anything in the rich sense of scientia requires that we know its causes as much and as well as we can. In the Aristotelian tradition, the sun is an instance of a cause that is indispensable within the created order, and as such, we naturally desire to understand it and its causality. The sun is not, however, in the capacious metaphysical account of Thomas, the only or even the highest cause. It itself, like all other beings, depends on a cause for its existence, and so to understand it, we must ascend to the very highest being, that than which none greater nor more universal may be conceived. Confronted with this reality, for Thomas, we have to acknowledge the limits of our ability to know. In one of my favorite passages in the entirety of the Thomistic corpus, Thomas reminds us that it may well happen that what is in itself the more certain may seem to us the less certain on account of the weakness of our intelligence, which is dazzled by the clearest objects of nature as the owl is dazzled by the light of the sun. Now, this quote does not mean that we should give up on attaining knowledge of this highest being. Thomas immediately continues, "The slenderest knowledge that may be obtained of the highest things is more desirable than the most certain knowledge obtained of lesser things." In examining the various passages concerning the sun today, we've seen that the underlying and primary goal of these references is the illustration of an underlying principle: universal causes, causes which stand in real relations to many different effects. If the task of Aristotelian Thomistic philosophy and contemporary science is to identify and explain reality, then the connections explained by universal causes must be investigated by both. Insofar as both of these disciplines are concerned with reality, with what is, then there can be no contradiction in principle between two disciplines. The identification and account of universal causes offered by philosophy offers contemporary science a unified, orderly account of reality. Such an approach must surely enrich subsequently specialized scientific investigations. The conclusions reached from general principles, including universal causes, however, can, must be tested to see if they conform to reality, and if not, then they ought to be rejected. It is here that contemporary science has much to offer. Many thanks.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.